This is Amber Ray.
And Rusty Tanton.
You're listening to Mostly ITP on the Georgia Podcast Network, the show that proudly farts in elevators. In this episode, Rusty talks to Laura Fries and Aaron Karp, web editor and webmaster of Creative Loafing, a weekly alternative newspaper.
I'm here with two folks from the online staff. If you could just introduce yourselves and just say a little about yourselves.
Okay, my name is Laura Fries. I'm the web editor for Creative Loafing, and I'm also an avid blogger. Check me out at laurafries.com.
Nice plug.
I'm Aaron Karp. I'm one of the two webmasters at Creative Loafing, and I don't own my name as a domain name, unfortunately.
But you're a podcaster.
Yes, you can check out Creative Loafing's podcasts at atlanta.creativeloafing.com. I am on Ed Loves Bacon, which is also at edlovesbacon.com. And I produce Audio Floss, which is at audiofloss.com. And I sit around while other people work on Earshot, which is our other big podcast. Earshotatlanta.com.
Shameless plugs.
Yeah, that's what this is all about. Okay, neato. First of all, could you just each tell me just very briefly about your path to Creative Loafing? Where'd you come from? What have you done before that sort of encouraged you to come over here?
I guess I'll start because I'm actually kind of part of Aaron's path, and
yeah.
I am senior. I am 24, and I've been working in the alternative newsweekly industry since I was in college, so that's actually a little over 3 years now. And I worked at a paper in San Antonio, and then one in Tampa, our sister paper, The Weekly Planet. And was a writer and made the leap to online a little over a year ago. So it's been an interesting ride.
Cool. I come out of my parking lot and I take a right. And that's not what he meant.
Yeah.
Anyway, as Laura said, she's part of how I got to be here. I've been in Atlanta for about 8 years now, and I started out working at Mindspring as a, I like to say phone monkey, but tech support representative, and eventually moved into their web design department and learned just a whole huge amount of information from the people who worked there. And then they merged with Earthlink. I worked in their internal tools department for about 2 years and then was laid off and fumbled around for about 2 years trying to find a job that didn't make me want to punch people. And Laura put a post, was it on Craigslist?
Uh-huh.
I responded to the one on Craigslist saying she was looking for somebody to help work on the website. And I said, I can work on websites. And and then interviewed with Laura and didn't hear anything back, which she said I wouldn't hear anything back because they were in the midst of launching the last version of the website. And then got a call a little bit later from somebody completely different, my current boss, Murray, who said, do you still want the job? And I said, yes, I do. And shortly after that, was hired on.
Okay, since I've been reading The Loaf, this is the third version of the website. I don't know if there were versions before that, but my history goes back 3 versions. The last version, which was the version before the one that launched last week, that was relatively new, right? It wasn't that old. When did that come out?
That launched on July 27th.
I'm
sorry? For the second time. We did actually have a faux launch on, gosh, it was the late May that was only up for half a day, and there was a lot of bugs, and we had to bring it down very quickly.
I'm one of the few people who saw it, actually.
Yeah.
I wrote you an email. I was like, hey, it looked nice. And then I went back after that, and it was gone.
Yeah.
Yeah, familiar story. I worked for a large corporate website as my pay-the-bills job, and we go through a lot of that. And the AJC recently went through the same sort of thing, launching their website. They had it up, and there were just massive bugs. And anyway, what was it that motivated The Loaf in general to want to go to a new website from what was already up there?
You mean the initial launch of the July 27th
Well, either
website?
Way, but the new one in particular, but both, because it seems like that they would be related.
They were both prompted by switches in content management systems. the first switch, I'll just tell you guys the name of the software, unless we're going to be libeling the people. Do you think that's libel?
Well, we're talking about the experience we had with it.
Okay, the first vendor that we worked with is called DesertNet. We love them. They're awesome. Mm-hmm. And that product was Dispatch. And then corporate made a decision to switch to a vendor called Publicus that was a daily web software. And that was the switch that you saw from July 27th up until last week, which was February, I guess, the 15th. So for that period of time, we used the Publicus daily software. And it's a good product for daily papers, but mm-hmm. when it came to what we needed, it really didn't work. So after trying it out for a little while, we decided we would go back to our initial vendor, DesertNet, and work with their newest version of their mm-hmm. software. So we transitioned over to Gyrobase, and that's the transition that's now, or that's the software that's powering the site right now.
You can see that in some of the URLs. I saw Gyrobase uh-huh. on there. Why did the Loaf evaluate any tools, any of the open source tools floating around like Mambo, Drupal, anything like that?
That was all prior to both of our tenures here,
yeah.
but
okay.
I'm fairly certain that we did not. And Aaron and I have personal leanings mm-hmm. towards that. But when
I'm a geek, so I have to like open source.
Yeah, you get real used to it. It's kind of automatic, but
yeah, and I think that in the future it'd be really smart for newspapers to do that mm-hmm. sort of thing. But when you're in an organization that's got like responsibilities, mm-hmm. taking that kind of a gamble with something that's a fairly large part of your business is a risky thing.
Oh, certainly. I think there's an automatic sense among. Among corporations, and this is something that I ran into at Earthlink as well, I worked with people who were all dyed-in-the-wool open source devotees, and they ran into hardship when they were saying, I can make this for you free, you want to spend $2 million to buy it, that doesn't make sense to me, but what the corporate response typically was, and it's a valid one, I don't want to sound as though I'm poo-pooing it, I'm not at all, is that there is a sense that you're going to get better, more consistent, and more responsive support when you're paying for something. When you're just using something that people from all over the world developed in their spare time, a lot of them have matured into companies that will actually have support contracts that you can buy, but there's still a fear. And the funny thing is, it's sort of a two-sided issue. The response of the developers at Earthlink was always, yeah, but my tool's going to work. You don't need support if it just plain works. And they weren't just blowing smoke. I mean, these guys were brilliant, and they made tools that were as bulletproof as you can make them. But the other issue is people are not, especially with computers, are just not that apt to trust the idea that it'll just plain work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are very valid concerns, it seems, with both the open and the source, closed source approach, because you're sort of at the mercy of the vendor. I mean, and if they offer great support, that's fine. And if they don't, then you're kind of up the creek. You
yeah.
can't get in there yourself. You can't even say, I want my engineers to look at this.
But, right.
Anyway, getting back to your website, there have been a lot of podcasts that have just started popping up on there. Even John Sugg, stalwart journalist, has got one now. And they've convinced Doug Monroe and Sugg and a couple of those other guys to start blogging even.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when Sugg started his blog, he wrote on there, well, this is a great way for them to get seven times as much writing out of me.
Now, I remember that post.
How hard was it? How much were you guys involved in trying to convince these folks to do this?
We actually came in at a kind of a neat period with Creatable Thing because they had made the decision that they mm-hmm. were going to try and do more online stuff. They didn't really know what. They were like, I want one of them blog things.
I want one of them on our blogs.
And they were like, we have a girl who blogs. Why don't we just put her in charge of that?
Just throw her over there.
And so I started working with the blogs. And then when it came to podcasting, they really just told Aaron and Edward, our other webmaster, to just do it.
They didn't even say, hey, you guys podcast. They were like, do you podcast? And we said, no. And they said, okay, you're podcasting now. And my favorite thing about it is Ed Loves Bacon, which is the one that I'm actually on, literally came to be because our boss said to me, I want you to set up and test our ability to do a podcast. And I did. Ed and I sat down, and I think it was 7 minutes of us just talking about whatever we felt like. And I thought when he said test our ability to do a podcast, he meant, you know, end to end, not just can we record. So I went and I wrote out the RSS feed and I registered it on iTunes, and Ed got kind of excited about it, went out and told his friends, and strangely, they
Ed
liked it.
Ed has hundreds of friends.
Ed is one of the most well-connected people I've ever met, and his friends liked it and demanded more. And so what was supposed to be a test became the first serious, well, not serious at all, but the first podcast we were doing regularly, and as Ed and I were doing that...
As in on a time clock.
Yeah, exactly. As soon as that was rolling a little bit, other people started having ideas for what they wanted to do with the podcasting medium, and we've got a great writer and also well-connected person, and he is Assistant Arts and Entertainment Editor, Carlton Hargrove, who came to Ed and I, because he's a friend of Ed's and now a friend of mine, and said, I want to do a show that's all about urban culture. And we said, sure, and that became all of a sudden another thing we were doing. And so it just sort of snowballed from there, and it's been really cool, because we've gotten to do a lot of stuff that, in some instances, couldn't make it into the paper because of timing, but the paper wanted to support. So Ed and I got to do a thing with Spelman recently. They were doing a big gala celebration to honor a woman named Moselle Spriggs, who had been the head of their arts department and had sort of brought a dance curriculum from nothing at Spelman into something very, very well respected. And they wanted to get in the paper, but they got their releases in late. So Ed and I packed up the podcasting gear, and we got to interview some great people and some celebrities and had a tremendous amount of fun.
But I think fundamentally, it's we were lucky in that our organization was ready to do these things, and they were ready and willing to let us experiment and spend time on them. And that's not the case for a lot of, you know, newspapers.
So. Size-wise, the loaf's a little smaller than something like... It's still got what? What's the circulation? Do you know off the top of your head?
I always forget.
It fluctuates from 168 to 140,000, and our readership is somewhere between 3 to 4 times that, because people pick up the paper.
And it's hard to tell probably harder to tell with a
free paper. Yeah, and that's not including our online readership at
sure.
all.
Sure.
I always put the paper back, which is probably bad, but whenever I pick it up, I end up putting it back.
It's good.
Just because I read it and
share the wealth.
Figure, well, this way I don't just throw it out. Someone else will use it.
Well, my personal fascination is in watching media companies adapt to all of this new online media that's just sort of exploded.
Yeah.
Because everything was based on a push model. You know, a network broadcasts something at a certain time. You sit there and you listen to it.
I'm not going to answer. Sorry.
Everything now, you have Tebow and podcasts and everything that relies on a pull model.
Yeah.
And so part of my fascination is how are companies going to make money doing this?
Well, I think that's part of our fascination.
Yeah, I haven't met a media company that's figured it out yet. Everybody seems to be kind of flailing around and trying to decide how to make money on it, and the marketing people would probably be a little more apt.
We deal with the marketing people a lot, very, very directly. Especially as you said, we are a smaller organization, so marketing people need something answered. They don't send a memo; they walk right up to us and ask. And this is something that it's a point that we've been turning on quite a bit. With blogs, it seems like the idea has been, let's cram ads around it. And I shouldn't say cram, that's got a negative connotation, but let's put ads around it. With the podcasts, one of the things that we've been running into is the idea of something very similar to how NPR handles their donors, which is to say this portion of Ed Loves Bacon is brought to you by the Chubb Group or something. Obviously not the Chubb Group, but unless they want to, you can write us. We are really interested in that kind of sponsorship model. The ideal is a situation where it can be kind of innocuous like that. You don't get a sense that it's shaping the content. And it's not, let me drop a 30-second ad into the middle of your podcast.
Brought to you by Geritol.
Exactly. We hope that we can convince them that we've got core markets that they want. But I can't rule out the possibility that within one of our podcasts you'll be hearing, we'll be right back after these messages. But I think ideally it's unobtrusive, it's themed to what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there are certain people that are going to read John Sugg that are not necessarily going to want to listen to Audio Floss. And I think that our paper is lucky in that we do cover a lot of demographic sections. And the online stuff, because of the ease of production and the cheapness, the relative cheapness of getting stuff up quickly, allows us to, again, I don't want to say tailor our content to fit those niches, but we've got people in the paper like Carlton who has this interest, and this, it's not just an interest, it's an expertise. He loves urban culture, he loves urban music, so he can talk about it very authoritatively, and there are people that are going to want to be able to speak to those who follow that. So we're hoping that we can just say to them, look, we have this thing that reaches these people. If your product needs to reach those people, we'll mention it in some way that doesn't make us sound like corporate shills.
There you go. How do you get past the fast-forward button with that? I mean, do the ads have to remain very short and just very punchy? Do you say, just brought to you by so-and-so, go to www.com, and then leave it at that?
That would be my personal opinion as to what we end up developing. We certainly haven't figured that out yet.
Well, I think my thought is, kind of as I was just saying, if you can make sure that the ads that you're offering have some bearing on what the people actually care about. I think there's something of a misconception, and I'm a TiVo freak. I love my TiVo, and one of the features that has just completely addicted me is fast-forwarding. I can't watch live TV. Mm-hmm. Ads bug me. But I don't feel like I hate all ads. I never want to see an ad. It's just stupid ads that have no appeal to me. So if we can make the ads that are going to appear in there short and inobtrusive, but also, it's unobtrusive, not inobtrusive, but anyway, if you can make them, relate to what is being talked about in more than a superficial, we're speaking in slang, but we're still trying to sell you Depends undergarments kind of way.
Which actually sounds awesome.
I'd love to hear that, but... But if it's a product they want and need anyway, there's no harm in throwing it in a little bit.
That's been sort of Google's approach with their text ads and their search engines. They actually, it borders on a little creepy to me, but they take your previous searches, especially if you have a Gmail account, mm-hmm. and then tailor all of that, both in your Gmail and in the Google text ads, to whatever you've been searching for recently.
Right.
And Amazon does sort of the same thing. And I don't know how that applies to a media company, though, other than, you're obviously listening to this kind of show, so we, like you said, we give you an ad that's very similar to that. But anyway, from the other podcasts, what other podcasts have we got at The Loaf on the website here?
Well, we've got a few that are a little bit, I don't know what the right word to use is. I don't want to make them sound as though they're... ignored internally, but there are some that are sort of self-producing, so I tend not to remember them as much as I should.
I know them all.
I know them all too. But we've got some good ones. We've got our monthly event, Political Party, which is at Dad's Garage Theater, where we get all sorts of guests that come and answer audience questions and talk about specific issues, and that is now recorded and podcasted every month. It's also got a blog. We've got the Progressive News Hour.
Progressive News Hour was a segment that John Sugg did on a radio station.
WRFG.
Thank you. And we were putting that online. That's kind of on hiatus.
Mm-hmm.
We're also putting, Ken Adelstein has a segment on Air America called Air Loaf on Saturday mornings. We're putting that online. So the idea behind those sections, I think that's kind of like the two types of podcasts. One is like, we're doing this audio content or these events anyways. Why don't we try and experiment and podcast with it? It's, relatively easy to do. And then the second is like trying to produce actual shows. And among those, we have the Ed Loves Bacon, the Earshot Atlanta, which is a music podcast, the Audio Floss, which is an urban music podcast. And we are... What is the other thing I wanted to say? I thought I was doing really well then, and I guess I forgot.
No, I think that's all of them.
No, well, then we tried John Sugg doing a...
Well, yeah, we tried to do an actual live new content one with John, and I think it was our newness to the world of podcasting. We didn't quite know what we were doing at the time, so that was put on hiatus, and then the Progressive News Hour came up, and it was thought, okay, well, this will take the
place. Sorry to interrupt. What kind of mistakes were made in that one that people could learn from to say, we need to do this better next time?
I think the biggest difficulty we had with that, John is a great writer, mm-hmm. and he's got a great sense of humor, but anybody, when it's just them sitting in front of a mic, especially if it's not something that they've got a little bit of background in, has trouble keeping it as alive sounding, as if you're discussing with someone. You're actually bouncing ideas off somebody. So we actually talked a lot in the early days, and we just never brought it together, about getting John Sugg and Doug Monroe to do a show that was them bouncing stuff off of each other. I think is a really easy mistake to make. You think, I've got this great content producer, he'll be great on the mic, but you really need something to jazz it up, because you do have to keep interest.
Mm-hmm. I've noticed with some of the other podcasters I listen to floating around that their shows are much better when there's somebody else on there.
Yeah, you can get to droning really easily if you're not careful.
I think segments help a lot. I always pronounce this word wrong, interstitial music, mm-hmm. where you kind of get like a little mental break where you can kind of zone out and then come back to it. And I think, I don't want to say scripting, because we haven't even approached that, but having kind of a structure
outline
for how you want to intro something, you want to get to the meat of it, and then get out in the ways that radio people do. I mean, that's definitely new for, I think, writers to, you know, kind of get into that mode. So those would be my little...
Yeah, don't depend entirely on improv. Ed and I do that a lot, but we found that when we have stuff that we want to cover, it's almost impossible to cover it if we don't sit down and say, okay, here is how we're going to do this. Mm-hmm. And we fill in the gaps between the major outline points with improv, but you still have to know, otherwise you're going to run over time, you're not going to make any sense, so having some structure helps a lot. Good one, Laura.
Good work, yeah. I had something on my mind and I was going to ask. I was looking at, I'm a geek myself, so I actually looked at the code of the website. And I'm sure a lot of that's tied into the proprietary CMS, and I've worked at the company, and I know I can't control all the code. Just noticing that the layout was done in tables, for example, that doesn't always work as well like on a mobile device. Just curious if in the future that would the Loaf like to kind of move towards a standards-based design?
Oh yeah. This represents, it's not a great example of it, but it does represent an attempt to move in that direction. It is more CSS-based, but I also, this is kind of embarrassing for me, having been in web design as long as I have, I really haven't started to do full CSS designs, or I'm just now starting, and this represents a first stab at something in that direction. So that's more on me than it is on the content management system, but that's something that I feel pretty strongly about, and with a lot of the ideas that we're talking about, the proliferation of mobile devices, it really becomes completely necessary. It's not something you can ignore.
Yeah. You look at any given weblog now, and something that's built with divs and unordered lists, general mm-hmm. CSS-based design, you can look at it on a cell phone, and there's structure there, and it makes sense on a mobile. Like I said, the bigger the company you work for, the harder it is to get something like that ingrained in a company that's been doing that for a while. And just generally, a lot of web developers seem like they're still getting up to pace with that.
This uses a whole lot fewer tables than it would have.
I noticed that. I mean, it was like one layout table.
Pretty
something.
Much.
It wasn't anything awful or anything.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I think, too, it's important to note that creative loafing is really new to this idea of making the web great.
Absolutely, yeah.
And prior to hiring me, we just had one webmaster to do mm-hmm. three websites for three cities and all the other projects, and that was a big burden for one person, and now we've been lucky enough that we have expanded our staff to four people for all of these projects. And
steps
stuff.
In the right direction.
Yeah, we're getting there.
And we get the stuff done. It may not be as beautiful as it should be, but we're all working toward that. So and that's like one of the greatest things about the web, is that evolution is relatively cheap. Evolution is not necessarily easy, but easier. Mm-hmm. And iterative design is very real, and kind of everything we do, we can explain away as, oh, no, it's iterative, we're going to fix it later.
It's beta?
One of the things, and it's an improved design versus the last one, definitely.
Well, that's good to hear.
It seems to get things, sort of pace, tack things together a lot better than the other site did. I didn't really notice much on the old site about the podcasts and things, for example. There was a little bit there. There were a few links there, but they seem to be a more prominent feature on the site, the podcasts and the blogs. How long from the last version to this version was the development process? Because it couldn't have been right from when the last version went up.
No.
It was fairly soon after.
Well, discussion started pretty quickly because we knew that there were things that... we weren't totally happy with how they were working, so there was some discussion about how can we fix this within the current system, and then eventually that changed into, okay, if we go to the gyro-based system, how can we do this? And that was very helpful in that it wiped the slate clean. It's not, here are your limitations, it's okay, let's figure out exactly what we want and plan for that.
I'd say we started meeting in October.
Yeah, I think that phase of it really began.
And then started design work. Oh, gosh, did we even do any in November? Maybe it was all December.
I was noting to Laura the other day that the folder that I keep all of the work that I did on the site in is labeled 1205, so that seems to point to it being December. But I think we must have had something done in November.
We turned it around very, very fast, and that's why we all look as great as we do so often.
Yeah.
what kind of work weeks do you work?
It varies.
Week as if there's like a weekend,
as if there's
a period of rest.
Since the site has gone live, things have been a little bit better, but I've done a lot of very long days and nights and at least one 24-hour period of constant work.
Wow.
I don't remember if there were more than that, but it's easy to understand me not remembering things given those circumstances.
No doubt.
But it was, we definitely, to get it turned around that quickly, we put a lot of time in and a lot of effort and a lot of yelling and screaming and sweating and tearing of hair and sobbing under our desks, that kind of thing.
What kind of things would you like to do in the future on the web that's not already being done right now?
Well, we've got some stuff coming.
Well, the major thing that I would like to do that we don't have in our plans is we have absolutely no user-generated reporting. And that's a big, like, nerd thing for me because I'm primarily a journalist, and then I just kind of play around on the web stuff. And I would really love to experiment a little bit. And I don't want to say, like, a Citizen J model because I think those are, you know, they get ballyhooed and stuff. But just something small where you take, like, an existing community, a la one of the universities, and just kind of, like, be like, okay, you're going to do your own little, like, creative loafing Emory reporter. And, you know, just, like, something like that would be really fun for me because there's a lot of, like, communities in Atlanta that we don't even have the resources at all to address on a journalistic level. Mm-hmm. And if we could open it up to other people, well, we don't have the same restrictions as the AJC does. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're not afraid of the same things they are. We're okay with, like, bad words and people talking about sex and things that are, like, maybe a little risque, so I think it would be really fun to play in that zone. And then as far as things that we do have planned, there is a plan underway, and I don't know how much I should say about it, if I should be more discreet, but I'm fairly not discreet as a human being. But there's a lot of talk on, well, how do we make social networking work for us? And we have, hands down, the best events and locations database in our market, period, in all of our markets.
Wouldn't argue with that.
And the way that it's served online is so bad to the point, you know, we don't even use it. It hasn't been updated since 2000. So we have plans, future plans, to kind of give people the way to manage preferences in terms of how they would view the events and locations databases and start to accrue favorites and then start to see results based on their favorites. And then from there, it only makes sense to allow those folks to link their profiles together. And then you start getting something that sounds a little bit like a social network.
Mm-hmm. You know, something like a Friendster-ish, MySpace-ish.
In my head, I kind of call it Showster.
There you go.
But Aaron has told me that nothing can start end with a stir.
Not anymore, man. We gotta get away from that.
It's in my head. We'll come up with something better.
Stir.
Stir.
Yeah. Yeah. But, I mean, definitely making those more robust and more kick-ass and more of like a like all-day type of site is definitely where we want to go.
So something that combines your Friendster, your MySpace, with something that's almost like a Google alert for whatever events that are coming around. Maybe mm-hmm. like in TiVo, for example, you can set a keyword. I want to see every Dane Cook comedy special.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So you tell TiVo, I want to pick up Dane Cook. And it does it.
Mm-hmm.
So something like that, but with events, maybe.
Yeah, pretty much. You would be able to favorite your favorite locations and your favorite bands and things like that. If any of your readers, listeners have ideas, they can send them to us. We're still working on it. We can be open source in that respect.
There
open source
go.
Ideas.
As far as ideas go, which means we're not going to pay you.
Yeah. Well, exactly. Exactly. All right, well, I think that's... do you have any other thoughts? Because I think I've pretty much satisfied what I wanted to know.
Well, I don't know if we have other thoughts other than we are really open to hearing what other people think about the site and what they'd like to fix, and we don't get nearly enough feedback.
Yeah, that was what I was going to say, is that we just... I mean, part of it, admittedly, is us hoping that you'll write in, we love it, and we'll be like, oh, all those sleepless nights were worth something. But... as I said, it's an iterative thing, and if you tell us you hate X, we'll look at X, and we can't guarantee that we're going to change it to whatever you want, but...
Y is a possibility.
We really want to hear about ideas because we know that we don't have all the ideas out there. And
So the email address is online@creativeloafing.com.
Yeah, so. Anything at all, rants, raves, try and keep them at least coherent, but... we like to hear from people.
Awesome. Well, Laura, Aaron, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Glad we could do this.
Thanks a lot.
You can visit Creative Loafing on the web at atlanta.creativeloafing.com.
Thanks for listening to Mostly ITP on the Georgia Podcast Network. Visit us at gapodcastnetwork.com. If you know a Georgia band or a hippie with a guitar that would like to have their music featured in a podcast, have them contact us at info@gapodcastnetwork.com. This way, the ending of the shows won't seem so abrupt.